from Alaska to Florida, Illinois to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the 2024 presidential election cycle is now officially underway. Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies joins us for a look at how the field of contenders is taking shape. Party control of both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives will also be at stake in 2024, as both chambers are almost evenly divided. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Proposed changes to federal regulations governing franchise operations would be harmful to small businesses. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from R Street's Jared Dieterle. And his father and uncle were assassinated, but Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s request for Secret Service protection as he seeks the presidency has been denied by the Biden administration. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The 2023 elections are now history, and it's on to the 2024 presidential contest. For a look at the landscape as the campaign shifts into high gear, we turn to Keith Naughton. Keith is principal at Silent Majority Strategies and a frequent contributor to The Hill and The American Spectator. Keith, welcome to American Radio Journal. Keith, we stand now at the official beginning of the 2024 election cycle, now that the 2023 elections are behind us. As we stand here at the starting line, particularly on the Republican side, what do you see as far as the Republican presidential nomination? Donald Trump appears to have a big lead. Do you want to drill down on that a little bit?
Well, he is far ahead and in the national ballot test. So obviously, he's way ahead of everybody. I mean, he's really sucking up all the oxygen in the room, so to speak. He's all anyone talks about. His court cases are in front of everyone. So that gives him a huge advantage. The one issue for him is in Iowa and New Hampshire, he's not doing as well. He's about 15 points or so, maybe as many as 20 points worse than what his national ballot test is. So it's closer at the state level. So he still has a solid lead. But you could see the possibility that Iowa voters and New Hampshire voters could surprise people and give either DeSantis or Haley a surprise win in either of those contests. Nationally, you know, Trump has pulled ahead of Biden, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. He has led in the last 8 ballot test polls from a range of pollsters. Some are friendlier to him, some are friendlier to the Democrats. And he's done very well in some of the state polling as well, especially in the real battleground states. So, I mean, if the Democrats aren't worried, they better be.
Let's talk a little bit about potential alternatives to Donald Trump, because as you've pointed out, even though he's not performing as well in Iowa and New Hampshire, he's still leading. We had a very large field of candidates, Keith, that started out with the first Republican presidential debate. That has narrowed. Has anybody really staked the claim yet to being the top Trump alternative?
Well, I think Haley has begun to do that. DeSantis for the longest time, and I think they're very close to being about tied as far as the Trump alternative. DeSantis is doing better in Iowa. Haley is doing better in New Hampshire. You know, the interesting thing is that Haley really was nowhere back in August. She really saved her campaign with her debate performance, which was very strong. She did a great introduction for herself. She's come up a lot in the polls. It hasn't taken much from DeSantis. It's drawn a little bit from Trump. It's drawn from all the also-rans who are so slowly sort of slipping away. But she's also doing really well in the ballot test versus Biden. In fact, she's 5 to 6 points better than Trump everywhere. And that's even stronger when you understand that voters aren't really that familiar with her, and they like to play a little hard to get. So I think as people become more familiar with her, her numbers would be better. It's similar with DeSantis. when you look at Biden's numbers versus Trump and Biden's numbers versus DeSantis, his polling drops against DeSantis, but DeSantis' numbers aren't as strong as Trump. And again, that comes down to familiarity. So I think both DeSantis and Haley are doing better than Trump against Biden, but Haley's doing much better.
We have yet one more Republican presidential debate coming up in about a week or so here, Keith. Do you see that debate as being pivotal since it's the last one before we head into the actual voting?
I think it's a very important debate. And it's important because we've winnowed the field down to a smaller group. So there's more airtime for the serious candidates. Now, the first debate was the big cattle call, and that's fine. Everyone can have their shot at it. I think the National Committee and McDaniel made a big mistake in the second debate by not narrowing it down further to the more serious candidates. And I think that third debate, the scheduled the day after Election Day, was just completely ridiculous. So in spite of the poor leadership of our National Committee, I think these debates, though, have been very useful because they've rescued Haley's campaign. She was nowhere in August. She just had a pointless campaign going on, and she got a huge boost from her performance. And now we're at a point where we've got her and DeSantis. I think Ramaswamy will be on stage. He's kind of degrading rather quickly. Maybe Christie. I think that's a nice, tight group of different perspectives of people who are very well-spoken. And, you know, you got to hear what they have to say.
Looming large over all of this, of course, are, as you referenced a bit earlier here, Keith, all these court cases, indictments. The president has almost 100 different counts leveled against him in various venues. Does that have the potential to really shake up the race, developments in those cases?
I think it could. It depends on how quickly these cases move forward. I don't think these civil cases, like the current New York civil case, and I think there are one or two, there's at least one, there may be two cases going to trial in January on the civil side. I don't think they affect things that much as far as the voters are concerned. But the first criminal trial is scheduled for the beginning of March. There's a conviction by mid-May. That could be a huge problem for the former president. It's one thing to offer some sympathy for someone or to think that he's being unfairly targeted. And I think there's some reason to believe that, to be sure. But it's another thing to actually have a conviction on your record. Now, I've written in The Hill that I think there's a possibility that the former president could try the ultimate delaying tactic and fire his lawyers and push the trial back. And, you know, I need new counsel and they need to prepare and so forth. So I think he's still got an ace up his sleeve to try to delay the trials, because that's really his number one strategy. But we won't know that until February.
As for the incumbent president, you did say that Democrats should be concerned. How do you see the impact of the war that's going on between Israel and Hamas? It appears to have somewhat fractured the Democrat base. Is this yet another storm cloud for President Biden?
It is, and it points up a larger problem, which is that the Democratic Party is really a collection of interests that all hate each other, but they just hate Donald Trump more. And Trump is really the only glue holding them together. But we see within the party now, they have always had a large percentage of the Jewish vote, and they've attracted a sort of Arab vote in this far progressive left, and they're sort of strange ideologies and so forth that have conflicted with support for Israel. And that happens throughout the Democratic Party. You know, you've got a labor versus environment issue. You've got an issue of sort of centrists and hawks on inflation versus the progressive left, who they just love inflation. So you've got a lot of disparate groups that would be fighting each other if they weren't united against a common enemy. And this is just a sign of that. And even with Trump on the ballot, I think you could have some Democrats stay home because they just can't stand what's going on.
We have been talking with Keith Naughton. Keith is principal at Silent Majority Strategies. You can also read his writings in a variety of places, including The Hill and The American Spectator. Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you.
Continuing our discussion on the start of the 2024 election cycle, we turn now to Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He joins us every week, and we're going to take a high-level overview of where races stand for the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
We did, and I hope you and your family had a great Thanksgiving as well. And I guess the Christmas season is now also officially underway. Relative to the U.S. Senate here, Scott, you have a situation now where both chambers are very closely divided. So what does the playing field look like for U.S. Senate seats as we enter 2024?
We still got that 51 to 49 U.S. Senate. And obviously there's a lot more Democrats that are facing re-election this time than last time when the Republicans went from 50-50 and the Democrats netted one seat. We've got competitive races all throughout the country, from the Commonwealth of Virginia, where I'm running, to your Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Montana, West Virginia. Joe Manchin already announced his retirement. That should be a solid Republican pickup. You've got competitive races in Nevada and Arizona. And then there's a couple of Republicans that are running important races, but we think are safe, like Ted Cruz and Rick Scott. Nonetheless, there's a good opportunity here for Republicans to win the majority in the 2024 election for the U.S. Senate. Over in the House, obviously things have been really tight. Everybody's been listening on this show to us talk about the drama between House conservatives, moderates, and the speaker, whether it's Kevin McCarthy or Mike Johnson. And we know that right now Republicans face a slight majority with four seats, but we've also got this real opportunity to strengthen that majority given the enthusiasm behind strong presidential candidate. And so I think that there is sort of this growing momentum right now. You're seeing it in local races. Even this week, there was a mayor's race in Charleston, South Carolina. And in that race, a Republican won for the first time in a couple generations, several generations, I should say. And so that's important because I think it's showing that Republicans are winning in the battle of ideas. I could go all throughout the country. I think we should do that and talk a little bit about some of the recent retirements that we've faced. Your next door neighbor in Ohio had a representative named Bill Johnson, and he decided to hang up his congressional pen, announced his retirement, and he's going to take the presidency over at Youngstown State University. Then you can go down all the way to the south, and in Texas, we've had several retirement announcements recently. The biggest one, I think, is the House Appropriations Chairwoman, Kay Granger, who has been a career politician, uniparty, big spender, really responsible for a lot of these huge deficits and the big omnibus appropriation deals as far as the Republicans are concerned. And so she announced she's not going to seek her reelection. Then Michael Burgess, who's kind of known as the doctor of Congress, he announced that he's going to retire as well. I think that's the 26th district over in the Dallas area that includes Keller. And then there's another guy named Pat Fallon. Pat hasn't been in Congress too long, and he announced he was going to retire from the U.S. Congress and go back to serving in the state Senate. He announced his candidacy for a state Senate race there, saying that Texas was really the battle line for saving America. And a day later, he said, you know what, I've actually changed my mind. I am going to run for my reelection here in the U.S. Congress. I've talked to my family, and that's what we're going to move forward with. So a little bit of a head fake, and a lot of people were wondering what was going on there. The way that I kind of look at this, Loman, is a real opportunity for Republicans to demonstrate that, number one, the Biden economy is completely failing the middle-class family. And we all see it. We saw it this week in Thanksgiving prices. You know, whether or not you were buying fresh food or whether you were buying your turkey or even just the cost of bread, there are all across the board dramatic increases in the price of food. And I think that's largely due to not only inflation, but the energy crisis. And we have this Biden energy crisis because Biden ended the Keystone Pipeline, right? He's had a war on fossil fuels for this radical green agenda from the Green New Deal, people like AOC. And honestly, that's crushing us at the gas pump. And that trickles down when you think about how the cost of diesel impacts transportation of food and other commodities. So really, the Biden economy, I think, is on the ballot. I hope Republicans tell that story. I think it gives us a chance to have a big win.
One of the big dramas still remaining before Congress is Congressman George Santos. He did announce his retirement, but it's possible, Scott, he might not even get that far?
Well, there's a chance that he could be expelled from Congress. And really, this is the kind of thing, and when you open up the history books, that happened to members of Congress that were a part of the Confederacy and people that committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Obviously, George Santos has faced dozens of indictments on his own due to his campaign conduct in the 2022 election when he won his race. But the Ethics Committee came back with a pretty damning report on his behavior. And even though they had an expulsion vote earlier this year, now there's many members of the House that previously voted against expulsion that have publicly said, hey, I'm willing to vote for expulsion now that he's had his day in the Ethics Committee. So Santos announced that he would not be seeking re-election, but I guess the big question is, will he join the history books in being one of the only expelled members in the House of Representatives?
Always interesting to keep an eye on what's going on under the Capitol Dome with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We also have an organization called Club for Growth PAC, where Club for Growth PAC makes endorsements of candidates, economic conservatives, free market champions all throughout the country. If you want to learn more about the candidates we're supporting this cycle, check out clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Many familiar businesses are actually owned and operated by franchise holders and not by large national corporations. Changes in federal regulations could alter that relationship in a negative way. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Jarrett Dieterle of the R Street Institute.
Some new rules issued earlier this month by the National Labor Relations Board, that's the NLRB, could fundamentally change the way that franchises like your local McDonald's or Burger King, basically any fast food joint you might go to, how those things operate. And really, it's an attack on small businesses, as my guest today will explain. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest today is Jarrett Dieterle. He is a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute and the author of Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink, a book about the history of alcohol in the United States. We're not going to talk about booze with him today, though, but Jarrett, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the call.
No, thanks for having me, Eric.
Great to have you, as always. Let's start, before we talk about what the NLRB is doing, with a little bit of a background here on just how franchises kind of work. Because, like, I go to the drive-thru at McDonald's, I don't think about the business model behind all that. I just want my $1.99 chicken nuggets. How does that work, and like, how does this whole system kind of operate?
I think you're exactly right that most people don't realize what businesses really operate as franchises or not. But particularly in sectors like fast food, fast casual, you know, hotels, auto repair shops, retail stores, they all in some form or another often operate under the franchise model. And basically, all it means is that, you know, there's like the parent corporation, and then the independent outlets are exactly that. They're often independently owned, but they use obviously the branding and the procedures and the protocols that the parent has developed. And, you know, places like McDonald's, I think it's like over 90% of McDonald's outlets are not run by the corporate parent. They're run by, you know, independent local people in the community. You just can't tell the difference because they're obviously like all serving the same food. And obviously the reason it exists is it really helps, you know, businesses scale to size. I mean, McDonald's would really not realistically be able to run all the outlets it has all over the world if it was trying to do it all from a central location. And so that's why they do the franchise model. It's been very successful, obviously.
It's been very successful. It's obviously good for consumers as well as the small business people that own the franchises. And that now the National Labor Relations Board wants to change a pretty fundamental part of the way that relationship works between the parent company and the franchisee. Tell us what they're trying to do.
Yeah, so they've issued a rule making that is called a joint employer And essentially what they're doing is blurring the lines and merging more of the parent company and these individual independent franchisees. And the upshot of that is that, you know, things like workplace, labor law violations, or even collective bargaining with unions, instead of that just taking place with the individual franchisee or the independent franchisee, it is much easier for McDonald's parent corporation to get roped into that, whether it's litigation or collective bargaining. And, you know, that obviously doesn't make sense, because in a lot of cases it is just a localized issue that's going on. Obviously, the unions would much rather be able to organize with the parent corporation. But yeah, so that what it does is essentially kind of neuter effectively the franchise model, because all of a sudden it's not really operating the same, where it's actually like a distinction, and it's blurring the lines.
The benefit here from the union's perspective, right, is that they can negotiate like one wage, and that means that the workers who work in rural Indiana are going to get paid the same as McDonald's workers in like New York City.
Yeah, and I mean also like, I mean, the plaintiff's attorneys, right, that are, you know, doing lawsuits for workplace violations, I mean, they'd much rather sue the parent corporations than just independent franchisee in Indiana somewhere.
We're talking with Jarrett Dieterroll. He's a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, and he's got a piece that you can check out at Reason.com this week, taking a look at this new joint employer rule at the National Labor Relations Board, this new rule that they've put out there. Jarrett, not a whole lot of time left, but this is really just another attack by federal bureaucrats on the kind of flexibility that makes the economy work.
Yeah, it does. And we're seeing it more and more. I mean, we've seen things like tipped wage bans in places like Washington, D.C., where, you know, waiters can't make up the minimum wage with tips. And we've seen it with the crackdown on independent contracting in places like California. There's a lot of examples out there, which we obviously don't have time to go into, but it all fits under the rubric of businesses operate in different ways. It's a good thing. That's what gives our economy dynamism. And we're basically trying to one-size it, particularly on the progressive left, and make it all the same, which will make it less dynamic ultimately, and will hurt both workers and businesses.
Trying to one-size it, trying to perhaps supersize it as well, supersize the bureaucracy, if you will, bring it all back around to the McDonald's. I don't think they sell those anymore, right? That's a throwback for us 90s kids. We remember the supersize it ads. Jarrett, thanks for taking some time with us. This is really fascinating stuff, really interesting stuff. Thanks for taking the time and explaining it all here.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's Jarrett Dieterroll. He's resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, a friend of Reason Magazine as well. You can check out his latest piece at Reason.com. The headline there, New Labor Rules Will Screw Over Your Local McDonald's. You could also pick up a copy of his book, Give Me Liberty and Give Me a Drink. Great, great gift. Holiday season coming up. Grab a copy of his book and find more of his work online at rstreet.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Biden administration is refusing to grant Secret Service protection to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says this potentially puts the independent presidential candidate in harm's way.
Once again, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has encountered another security threat. And yet again, the Biden administration is refusing to provide the presidential candidate with Secret Service protection, despite multiple requests from Kennedy and his campaign team. The latest incident occurred when an intruder was arrested after climbing a fence at the Los Angeles home of Kennedy. Kennedy was home at the time, and the man made it to the second floor. In fact, he got in twice. The Kennedy for President 2024 campaign described this man in a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas as, quote, another delusional intruder, a mentally ill individual. In fact, they said, the Kennedy team, they told the Secret Service repeatedly that this mentally ill man was a threat to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. They said he has, quote, an obsession with RFK Jr. that leads him to be at times hostile and angry, unquote. The man thinks somebody's out to kill him. That being the case, the Kennedy team has continued to plead with the Biden administration for Secret Service protection, but to no avail. Prior to this most recent threat, there had been an incident in September where a man showed up at a side door of a Kennedy campaign event, identified himself as a U.S. Marshal, and immediately demanded that he be taken to see RFK Jr. He was carrying a loaded handgun plus a second gun with laser sight in his backpack. He was in possession of multiple clips filled with ammunition. Scary? Oh, yes. This story actually began unfolding last summer, when RFK Jr. posted a tweet in July that said, quote, "Since the assassination of my father in 1968, candidates for president are provided Secret Service protection, but not me," unquote. That was July. Then came the incident in September, when the armed man accused of impersonating a federal marshal managed to get into the rally in Los Angeles. Oh, by the way, that's the city where RFK Jr.'s father, the late, great Robert F. Kennedy, was assassinated in June 1968. In response to this, Kennedy campaign manager Dennis Kucinich wrote an open letter to President Biden that he also circulated to the press. It stated, quote, "Although it is a well-known historical fact, apparently, in your case, Mr. President, it bears repeating. Mr. Kennedy's uncle, President John F. Kennedy, was assassinated. Mr. Kennedy's father, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, was assassinated while a presidential candidate," unquote. Apparently, that does need repeating. If it seems to you like the Biden administration's inaction is politically motivated here, well, you're not alone. Kennedy and his team are certainly suspicious. RFK Jr. says this, quote, "It's not right for the president to provide protection to his family and political favorites while denying it to political rivals. During his first week as attorney general," said RFK Jr., "my father," that would be RFK Sr., "assembled all the DOJ's senior prosecutors to tell them that he would not tolerate any politicization of law enforcement. President Biden displays a bust of my father in the Oval Office, but he seems to have forgotten this critical tenet of American democracy. During his administration, we've seen the wholesale co-option of federal law enforcement agencies to serve other political ambitions," unquote. RFK Jr. has gotten so fed up that the lifetime Democrat, from a family of Democrat royalty no less, went rogue a few weeks ago and decided to go third party. And you can be sure that that third-party declaration terrifies the Biden administration. And now, RFK Jr. has taken another bold step. He has filed a lawsuit against the Biden administration. Filed with the D.C. District Court, the lawsuit includes Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests seeking access to all communications, including emails, memos, text messages, sent or received regarding his requests for protection. Clearly, RFK Jr. wants to get to the bottom of why, precisely, he's being denied security protection, even as threats accumulate. Indeed, there is no good reason for the Biden administration refusing Secret Service protection to this man, especially, one would think, to the son of the late Robert F. Kennedy Sr., who was assassinated as a presidential candidate. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KEST-AM in San Francisco, California, KTLX-FM in Columbus, Nebraska, along with WMBS-AM and FM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program by visiting our all-new website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.